Chapter 12. He received a call from the front desk an hour later. Annalise was still asleep, so he rushed across the floor to snatch up the phone before it could ring again. Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Guittery. This is the front desk. I'm calling to inform you that a package has arrived for you.
Yes, excellent. Send it up, please.
I'm sorry, sir. I would have, but I cannot. The messenger requires you receive it personally.
He almost asked her to send the messenger up with the package, but then realized what the problem must be. Messengers aren't allowed among the rooms, then?
No, sir. It makes the guests uncomfortable.
Of course. I'll be down momentarily.
Thank you, sir.
The messenger crouched low over the package on the lobby floor like some giant prehistoric insect sucking the life from a small mammal. Giles nodded to the receptionist, who smiled back at him beneath flat eyes, and approached. It detected his proximity within 10 feet, and a collection of blades began to churn the air silently, the unit beeping all the while. As it rose from the ground, Giles marveled, as he always did, at the ability of each rotor blade cowling to quiet the drone's passage, and smiled at the irony that such silence required the steadily beeping alarm to keep people from walking into it. They might have just left the rotors loud and avoided the hassle. It approached slowly with the package, regarding him with its single fisheye lens. He tilted his head back so it would have a direct shot of his face and said, "Giles Guittery." There was a brief pause, then a pleasant musical chime. The parcel to which it clung lowered by an inch and then was dropped into his outstretched hands. Giles noted the messenger's stabilization logic was exquisite. It rose no more than a centimeter when the ballast was released, and Giles was nearly certain he heard the rotor slow beforehand, but it had been so close. He did not know which had occurred first, not for sure. He watched the messenger as it departed, and then rushed back to the elevator, beginning already to peel the wrapping away with a clutching left hand. Kevin Roth was as good as his word. Giles found himself back in the boardroom at 2:15, setting up for a 2:30 presentation, somewhat shocked at how quickly things had been arranged. Kevin carried himself with an easygoing air, yet it must be that he had some serious pull. Executives lived their lives meeting to meeting, as Giles well knew. The fact Kevin had the ability to restructure the day of so many people, people whose days must have been scheduled weeks in advance, spoke volumes. Giles tried not to fidget as the others began to filter in. Marcus came first, choosing a seat near the head of the table opposite Kevin. Then a collection of others wandered in to fill additional seats. Many of them trailed assistants in their wake that carried small laptops or tablets. The assistants took seats of lesser station along the wall and windows. Linnea and her satellites appeared 5 minutes late, and he wondered if that was intentional. He sat at the far end of the table, closest to the enormous display. He judged it to be something like 100 inches at least, and the appearance of his computer's desktop looked bizarre spread out over so much real estate. He sat silently and stared at the screen of his computer, listening with one ear to side discussions, muted coughs, the occasional joke, and resisted the urge to begin. Eventually, Linnea glanced at Kevin, who nodded at Giles. He knew then that there was to be no more delay. He threw the first slide of his presentation to the monitor and began. The double-slit experiment was a demonstration first performed in 1801.
Stop,
Marcus said. Giles turned to look at him along with everyone else.
Are you about to waste this room's time with an explanation of a high school science project? Is that really what you're about to do?
Giles managed to avoid stammering when he responded. He was pleased at this victory. I imagine, Mr. Gennaro, that much of this will be elementary for many in this room. However, I regret I must ask your indulgence as I go over the basics. Understanding is critical to— Marcus leaned over and began to whisper into Linnea's ear. Giles considered pressing on with his explanation, but saw little point in persisting if Marcus refused to listen. He glanced at Kevin, who only shook his head with an expression that said to just give it a moment. They chattered back and forth a while, Linnea impassive, while Marcus became more animated with each breath. Finally, Linnea cut him off by saying loud enough for all to hear,
I don't understand it, Marcus. It doesn't matter to me that you or anyone else does. I need to understand as well if I'm going to make any kind of decision. Now, will you let him continue or must I ask you to leave?
The conference room, though already quiet, became barren. Marcus dipped his head and leaned back into his chair.
He stared at the desktop disconsolately, and Linnea nodded to Giles. Please continue. He cleared his throat and struggled to regain his place. It was not easy with all those faces looking back at him.
Thank you. As I was saying, the double slit experiment.
He glanced at his computer, took a breath, and nodded. He thought for a moment about the speech he had prepared, about the assumptions he had made regarding his audience, and abandoned it all on the spot. He looked at Linnea only, and plunged ahead as if she were a life raft at the center of a churning ocean. I'll ask you to imagine for a moment that you're in a dark room with a flashlight. You shine that flashlight against a wall. What do you see? Linnea glanced momentarily at the others and then said, "The beam of light projected on the wall." Exactly. Now I'll ask you to imagine placing a shield in between the flashlight and the wall. Imagine that the flashlight has a narrow beam so that the light it emits can't get around the side of the shield. You see the light hitting only the shield, right? It does not reach the wall on the other side. Linnea nodded. Thank you. Now, cut a vertical slit in that shield. What happens?
The light gets through to the wall again.
And does it look the same as it did before? Linnea thought it over. No, it's focused through the slit.
Yes, Giles nodded.
He pressed a key on his computer, and a slide appeared on the monitor depicting the scenario he had just described. The resulting band of light on the wall was rendered as a vertical white bar, diffuse around the edges. You'll note, he continued, that the edges of the light fade to the sides. There's a good reason for this. Do you know why it is?
Linnea nodded, moved to speak, and then thought for a moment.
Then she said, Well, light travels in a wave, so it's not going to be sheared off perfectly by the hole in that shield. It just radiates out.
Exactly, Giles smiled.
He tapped his computer again, and an animation appeared. It showed a gun firing balls at a shield with a vertical slit. Many of the balls hit the sides of the shield itself and stuck to it, but many passed through the slit as well, where they stuck to the wall beyond in a thin vertical line. What you've just zeroed in on is the difference in behavior between particles and waves. A particle behaves in what we call a corpuscular fashion. It's a finite bit of matter that moves as you'd expect. It travels in a straight path. We can predict its position accurately, and for lack of eloquence, it behaves more or less like the balls you see in this animation. A wave, however, is different. The image on the monitor was replaced with a new scene. It showed the same shield with a slit in the middle, now lowered into a tub of water. The flashlight, replaced with a floating ball, was placed on the water surface and pushed up and down vigorously so that waves radiated out from its edges. These waves traveled toward the shield, passed through the slit, and began to radiate again from the other side. Giles said, Notice here that when the waves pass through the slit, they are focused down to the width of the slit and then widen out again on the other side of the shield. It is as though the slit acts as a new wave source independent of the ball, which it is. The wave widens out again as it travels, impacts the far wall, and the part of the wave that hits the wall first, its leading center edge, describes the point of greatest impact. Light behaves just as the water in this animation. It hits the slit of the shield, is focused, and radiates out again toward the wall, and the point of greatest impact is where you see the brightest light, the vertical bar of diffuse light. Everyone with me so far?
Linnea nodded while Marcus rolled his eyes.
Kevin winked.
Good. Now I'll ask you to consider particles again. Please bear with me.
The monitor showed the ball-firing gun. Only this time, the shield had two vertical slits running parallel to each other. Those balls that managed to pass through each slit defined two vertical lines against the far wall. Now we have the famous double slit. In the case of corpuscular behavior, we can see how particles passing through each slit create two vertical bars on the far wall, correct? May I ask you to predict the result of a wave passing through the same double-slit shield?
Marcus sat up as if he would speak, glanced at Linnea, and then settled back into his chair again with a sigh. She peered at the screen for a moment, eyes narrowed, and Giles briefly wondered if he had overstepped. Finally, she said, I assume two bands of light just like the balls. But I'm also guessing that's not the case, otherwise you wouldn't have bothered to ask.
Giles nodded and placed a still image on the monitor.
It showed the light source, the double-slit shield, and on the far wall, a wide band of alternating bars of dark and light, repeating like horizontal train tracks. Linnea sat up in her seat at this, betraying interest despite her usual reserve. She said, "Mr. Guittery, I as yet have no idea what this has to do with the problem at hand, and yet I must admit, you have my curiosity for the moment. I think we'd better pick this up, though." Giles winced and said, "I know, ma'am, it is painfully slow, but I promise you this is all relevant. It is so important that we understand the basics here before getting to the heart of the matter. If we get to the end of this and you feel as though I've spent your time needlessly, I invite you to pitch me out into the street." She smiled at this and said, "That's a deal. Thank you, ma'am." What you now see projected onto the wall is called an interference pattern. The reasons for its occurrence are surprisingly straightforward. However, to help us visualize it, we're forced to return to our tub of water. The image was replaced by the tub with the oscillating ball, yet the shield now featured two vertical slits. The single wave generated by the ball hit these and was divided on the other side in two waves traveling in the same direction at the same speed. The waves moved out in concentric circles, widening as they went, until the wave from one slit overlapped the wave from the other. The points at which the two wave edges intersected were highlighted brightly, and they projected out from the shield in diagonal lines, impacting the far wall at regular intervals. The wall glowed at the points where the wave intersections impacted, illuminating so that a pattern emerged like horizontal train tracks. "This should hopefully illustrate the phenomenon," Giles said. "Each point where the waves overlap describes a peak, a point of intensity greater than any one position on a singular wave. The two waves combine together at these peaks, amplifying each other, and create a repeating pattern of points of greatest impact along the wall. Again, light behaves just like water. It is just a wave, after all. And so you can now hopefully understand why we get an interference pattern when we project light through two slits. If something is corpuscular or behaves like a particle, then it will travel either through one slit or the other, and you get two bands of impacts on the other side. If something is contiguous, like a wave, it passes through both slits at the same time, divides into two separate wave sources, and then those two sources interfere with each other, create a repeating band of peak impact points on the screen, and that's why you get that picket fence effect." He glanced at Kevin to gauge how he was doing, who showed him an extended thumb partially hidden behind a forearm. Emboldened, Giles continued. "Now we get to the part of this experiment where all logic sadly falls apart. I'm speaking, of course, of quantum mechanics. You see, somewhere around 1927, scientists discovered that certain particles behave just like light, and this was really unfortunate because up to that point, we thought we had a handle on how the world works. Particles behaved like particles, and waves behaved like waves. Everything behaved itself, and that was good. But now they found that electrons, discrete particles that are observable as such, shot through the double slit produced an interference pattern, just like a light wave. Electrons are a thing that can be controlled to a finite degree. When they shot a stream of them through a double slit, the initial expectation was that because they are corpuscular in concept, two vertical impact lines would present on the other side of the shield. This is not what they observed. They got an interference pattern. So they started trying to understand what was happening and came up with all sorts of oddball theories about why this may be, stating that perhaps the electrons themselves were somehow splitting before passing through each slit, such that there were two coming out the other end, like our theoretical wave of water, and interfered in some way with each other on the opposing side. They tried to get some control of the situation by using a special gun capable of firing single electrons at the shield one at a time, just like a pea shooter. Again, doing everything they could to make the corpuscular particle behave in a corpuscular fashion. Giles changed the image on the screen to a new animation. It showed a gun pointed at a double-slit shield with a gray screen on the other side. The gun flashed at regular intervals to show that it was shooting. However, no projectile appeared. Instead, only the impact point of the projectile was highlighted as a small dot on the far screen. Impacts were shown one after the other. They sped up over time until a pattern began to emerge. The interference pattern of a waveform, now shown as a collection of thousands of dots on the screen arranged in tight, vertical clusters. "So, this is a big problem, right?" Giles continued. You have a gun that shoots a single particle at a time, which you know should be passing through either one slit or the other, not both, or not passing through at all if it impacts the shield. There should be two definite bands on the far wall, not an interference pattern. They scratched their heads at this for a while. A particle ought to travel in a more or less straight line. Their results suggested it wasn't. The results suggested something more like this. He switched the image. The electron gun flashed, and a diaphanous red wave emanated from the barrel, passing through the two slits like the water in the earlier example, divided into two waves, and impacted the wall. When they hit the wall, a single point was illuminated, seemingly at random. More waves fired from the gun, traveling and dividing in similar fashion. Each time the waveform impacted the wall, a new point was highlighted at random. The speed of the animation increased until thousands of impacts appeared, revealing the interference pattern. Individual particles moving through space in a wave pattern, said Giles. The next step, obviously, is to observe this behavior directly. So far as they could tell, in order for the electrons to behave this way, they would have to accept the idea that a single particle was passing through both slits at the same time. This was clearly an unsettling thought, challenging everything they understood, or thought they understood, about physics at the time. So what they did was place a measuring device on the opposite side of the shield that was capable of detecting when an electron passed through a slit, and if it did, would issue a little beep. Using that, they would be able to tell just what was happening. If the electron was passing through only one slit, or both, or some other as yet unimagined behavior. And when they did this, a horrible thing occurred. Suddenly, with the inclusion of the measuring device, the electrons ceased to function as a wave. They passed discreetly through either one slit or the other, and presented two vertical lines on the screen just like balls fired from a gun. In fact, just as the scientists had predicted would happen in the first place. No interference pattern whatsoever. Even worse, when they turned off the measuring device, the interference pattern reemerged, instantaneously. In other words, the simple act of observation collapsed the waveform and made the particle behave like a damned particle. What does that mean? Well, it means that each singular particle behaves like a wave as it travels, each one doing its own part to contribute to that interference pattern until it impacts the screen at a specific point, and suddenly at impact, it looks like a particle again. Unless you happen to watch it as it travels, at which point it just behaves like a particle for the entire trip. The fundamental behavior of the electron is changed just through the act of observation. Linnea was sitting bolt upright in her seat. She glanced over at Kevin, who nodded slowly, and then back at Giles. Despite the fact that he had not yet reached his actual point, he saw that she was fighting to hide a smile, and he knew he had her. He began to relax. It is the ability to collapse this waveform that I call your attention to. Hopefully, if I'm right, we can exploit this behavior to determine the state of Cronus. To determine, rather, if Cronus has achieved a conscious state. Marcus raised his hand to speak, and Giles nodded to him.
If the rest of you will allow me, I'm perfectly familiar with the double-slit experiment. Giles, if I may, how do you propose to do this? Conscious observation is not required to collapse the waveform. You just need to use a device to monitor the electron. I can do that with a simple piece of hardware for a bit of cash.
In answer, Giles said, I would now like to direct your attention to one Dr. Peter Nowak. He conducted a number of experiments into the nature of consciousness some years back using the double-slit platform as a foundational basis, a kind of measuring device, if you will. The configuration of his test was modified in certain ways from the classical double-slit experiment. The monitoring device was first removed. The system itself consisted of a helium neon laser projected through a neutral density filter toward the double slit, and on the other side of that, they set up a CCD line camera. The double slit and camera were placed inside a box in a sealed system configuration. This part is important. It means that the double slit itself cannot be observed, either by instrument or organism. The line camera was 3,000 pixels long, capable of detecting patterns of light and dark, just like the classical interference pattern we've already covered. Now, the light bands of the interference pattern closest in proximity to the double slit, the center of the pattern, are brighter than those out to the side, which are further away. When you plot these values of intensity in a computer, you get something that looks rather similar to a bell curve. This information is run through a Fourier transform, which results in a value representing the total spectral power of the waveform. He had been flipping through slides rapidly during this part of his presentation, pausing briefly at each to show a succession of test diagram, hardware configuration, and various charts. He ended on two graphs, the top of which showed the bell curve he had mentioned, while the bottom displayed a reading of total spectral power. This bottom graph looked to Linnea like the digital thump of a heart monitor. "And now we come to the part of the experiment that most benefits our situation," Giles continued. "The difference between an interference pattern and a fully collapsed waveform. In other words, those situations where the particle is actively measured as it passes through the slit is quite extreme. On one hand, you have the complete behavior of a wave, and on the other, the complete behavior of a particle. It's almost as if they're digital states, isn't it? But as we all know, and sometimes like to complain over, the entirety of reality is an analog experience, spectral in nature, reducible only to matters of degree, frequency, and intensity. A true or false state is really just our gross attempt to speed up and simplify the process of computation and observation." The hypothesis of his test was simple. If the act of direct observation with a mechanical device could completely collapse the waveform, would indirect observation have a similar or measurable effect? Again, this underlines the importance of the double slit being a closed, unknowable system. He asked test subjects to concentrate on the double slit for 30-second intervals in such a way that they desired the photons to prefer one slit to another. He was interrupted by a loud snort from Marcus's end of the table. He had expected this. I know, it does indeed sound crazy. But I'll ask those present to consider. Whether you first learned about the details of the classical double-slit experiment today or back in your college years, did you not have the very same reaction when you learned that the behavior of the electron changed fundamentally in response to nothing more than being observed? When you grasped what this truly meant, did you not also have the same reaction? Doesn't the basis of quantum mechanics sound preposterous on its face given what we observe every day? He had them again. A whole room of faces stared back at him, faces that spoke of bodies poised on seat edges. Marcus produced his phone and began to tap out a pattern on the screen under narrow eyes. Giles did not know what he searched for and chose to ignore him. The protocol of the experiment was to measure the differential spectral power between mentally observed and non-mentally observed periods. Each session was broken into 30-second intervals of concentration, alternating with 30 seconds of rest for a total of 20 minutes. They ran the usual control tests without any human participants at all, establishing a baseline of spectral power, and then brought in their test subjects for a few initial pilot studies. One of the things they learned early on was that some people tended to do better than others, repeatedly so, and there was a bit of time lost in re-examining the system and the hardware to determine if there was some sort of error or bias. In all of their control runs, the zero baseline they produced was as expected, so it appeared there were no system artifacts or biases throwing off the test. They began to examine their test subjects closer and realized that certain of them were of a more spiritual bent. Yoga practitioners, strongly religious folk who engaged regularly in prayer, martial artists, Buddhists, and others who frequently practiced meditation. What they found was that people who were used to applying themselves to a cognitive task for extended periods of time simply did better than the average subject. They further modified the test to distinguish between meditative and non-meditative subjects, and this is where things became rather shocking. He shifted to a new slide showing a long graph of results spanning multiple years and thousands of people. Little colored points dotted the graph like a histogram, and throughout its length, there were regular clusters of yellow dots well below the zero baseline. The results show that the meditative test subjects were able to achieve at or close to a 5-sigma standard deviate result in every case. In essence, that conscious, indirect observation was capable of instigating a waveform collapse. Not a full collapse, of course, but it would appear that the impact on the system was measurable. "I would like to adapt this experiment for Cronus. Assuming the results of Noack's tests are sound, this may be a means to determine if we are dealing with a true consciousness or just the incredible simulation of consciousness. If Cronus can produce results comparable with that of a human test sub..." There was a guffaw from the back of the room so loud and sharp it made Giles flinch. He said, "Yes, Marcus, you have something further?" Gennaro was bent over the table, shoulders quaking, and the others at the table regarded him uncomfortably. Kevin hissed a few angry words at him, and he only lifted a hand to fan the admonishment away. There was nothing to do but wait for him to regain control, and when he did, he smiled at Giles as he dabbed at the corners of his eyes with a knuckle.
"Let me ask you one thing, Giles. The results of this Mr. Nowak study..."
"Dr. Nowak," Giles said.
"Fine. Doctor. This doctor's study, was it peer-reviewed or replicated by any independent parties?"
Giles cleared his throat. Sadly, I don't have that information prepared. Between yesterday and today, I had just enough time to review the data from the original studies, construct the plan to reproduce it here at Anik Norris's labs, and create the presentation you're now viewing."
"Uh-huh. I see. Would you mind disconnecting the feed from your computer? I'd like to pair my phone with that monitor for a minute."
Giles felt a hard iron spike push slowly through the vertebrae of his neck, as if some trap he could not understand was closing over his head. He wanted to refuse the request, but knew the response was born of panic. He knew he must do as he was asked, but that wolfish grin on Gennaro's face made him uneasy, like nothing else he had experienced in the last several days. Marcus tapped the screen of his phone some more, and the monitor at the end of the room showed a giant image of Dr. Peter Nowak's face, along with a biography covering his educational and professional history, a listing of his publications, and his standing within the scientific community. From somewhere behind him, Giles heard Kevin grunt, "Oh, Christ." He stood out in the hallway with Kevin a few minutes later. The man fumed, fists shaking in spasms as he growled, "A fucking parapsychologist. Well, I can explain. Have you seen some of the books he's released? Evidence for latent psychic abilities? The untapped power of the human mind? He hasn't a doctorate in the field of physics, psychology, or psychiatry. He's a goddamn programmer. Jesus Christ, Giles. You might as well be one of the Ghostbusters. Kevin, why the hell would you present this without first checking this guy out? Whatever happened to due dil-" Giles took a step forward and snarled up into Kevin's face. "Hey, what the hell do you expect? You know damned well what I'm being asked to do here. You know perfectly well how long it would have taken to do the job right. You people cut my time for a near impossible task down to a week, and you have the nerve to get bent out of shape when I start grasping at straws?" Kevin Roth was not used to having people address him in this fashion. He stood with his back pressed up against the wall, poleaxed. Giles did not seem to care. "One week to get it figured out, and if I get it wrong, maybe I can sign some new, whatever the hell it is, to a life of slavery. Let me tell you, Kevin, I've gotten enough things wrong in my career so far. I'm not fucking this one up. You geniuses want to cut the time down. It was clear to me that I had to do something, anything, to buy some more time. At least enough time to have a chance. This evaluation you want, it takes months at least, not days. Maybe years to be certain, and you want days. You might as well ask me to toss a fucking dart. I know what I'm asking for sounds like a long time, but God damn it, at least you'd be sure of the results. The best I could come up with was to generate a concrete number those fucking imbeciles," he jabbed a finger at the conference room door, "would take notice of and buy me the time I needed to do it right. It was a mad goddamn dash, and this is the one thing I could find that was even remotely applicable, and your laughable fucking security is doing nothing to simplify the process." Kevin had his hands up to soothe. He looked up and down the hall nervously as Giles's voice amplified and said, "Okay, calm down. Calm down, Giles. You're right. You're right. I apologize. Please." Giles took a few moments to decide if he wanted to be calm. He decided he had gone far enough and nodded. "I'm sorry," Kevin repeated. "It's just, I was a little thrown in there. You have to admit it's a bit of a shot to the nuts." Giles had to concede. "If I'd had time to discover the source, I would have searched for something of more credibility. But you saw the same results I did, Kevin. Can you not agree they look promising?" "You're not saying you want to go through with it." Giles spread his hands. "What else do I have, Kevin? I need to provide a result that creates enough doubt to do this job the way it deserves. I promise I've been down the rabbit hole on this. Given the time frame, this is the best I've found." "Christ, Giles, I don't know. You showed us some interesting results, but I'd have to look at the details of the actual study before I could tell you if they were any good or not. You're a doctor. You understand." He sighed. I do. I can't believe you didn't go through the data yourself. I did.
Kevin looked at Giles closely.
When? When did you have the time?
He took a step closer and ducked his head.
Jesus, when was the last time you slept? You're a mess.
I'm not sure. 30 hours ago? 36? I'd have to add it up on paper. I can't work it out in my head.
Kevin rolled his eyes.
And did you review the data of these studies within that interval?
Giles nodded.
What choice did I have? There's not enough time.
Kevin hung his head and shook it sadly.
God damn, Giles. How serious are you about this? How much do you believe in this study?
I'm getting ready to go back in there and tell them we should let you take a crack at it, but I need to know that you're still committed to this. And I'll also tell you right up front, if this turns out to be a joke, I'm not going to be one of the guys that gets laughed at. I'll roll you right under the bus on this one.
A fucking parapsychologist, God help me.
And put this squarely on your shoulders. It'll be your ass alone that's on the line, 100%.
You still want to go through with it?
Giles shrugged, then nodded.
Fine, said Kevin.